the National Airlines 727 time slip. A plane obviously heads down on the way into an airport. What if it then hits a relatively small vortex into time-space? In 1974, Charles Berlitz wrote a tantalizing three-paragraph summary of an event just like this in his classic book, The Bermuda Triangle. In this account, Berlitz says the plane was approaching from the northeast, meaning it would be traveling southwest. But as we will see, Martin Kaden interviewed many more eyewitnesses and said the plane was coming in west of Miami International, meaning it was traveling east, making it even more likely to be heading into the future if it did hit such a vortex. An incident involving time-lapse occurred at the Miami airport about 5 years ago, which has never been satisfactorily explained. It concerned a National Airlines 727 passenger plane, which, on approach to landing from the northeast and being tracked on radar by the Air Control Center, suddenly disappeared from the radar screen for about 10 minutes and then reappeared. The plane landed without incident, and the pilot and crew evinced some surprise over the expressed concern of the ground crew since, as far as the crew was concerned, nothing unusual had happened. By way of an explanation, one of the air control staff said to one of the pilots, "Man, for 10 minutes you just did not exist." It was at this point that the crew checked their watches and the various time indicators in the plane and discovered that they were uniformly 10 minutes slow according to real time. This was especially remarkable as the plane had made a routine time check 20 minutes before the incident, and at that time there was no time discrepancy. There seems to be much missing from this story if it is really true. You have an entire plane full of people who spontaneously popped 10 minutes into the future. If they were at 8:50 p.m. when they went in, they were still at 8:50 p.m. when they came back out, even though everyone else's watch now said 9 p.m. Thankfully, a pilot and researcher named Martin Kaden did a much more thorough investigation of this incident and reported his results in his 1991 book, Ghosts of the Air. Kaden didn't just read books about it. I spoke to some of the people involved, airline captains, friends of mine who aided in research, officials of the Federal Aviation Administration, a literal host of investigators all pooled their information to bring it together before I put this down on paper. Kaden writes that the 727 was coming in for a landing at Miami with all their equipment working just fine. The pilots followed the air traffic controller's instructions and turned the plane when they were asked to, heading in on the invisible corridors they were assigned. Then, without warning, their blip on the radar disappeared. Of course, this could be caused by electrical failures, radar glitches, or a crew member switching off the transponder system. But it also meant the 727 could have crashed into the swampy ground far to the west of Miami International. Now, by necessity, there was a real panic. Immediately, the alarms sounded. The reactions are automatic. The word goes out from Miami approach and departure and the tower for all aircraft in that sector to look for a 727 that's gone off the scope. Pilots strain to see any signs, a reflection of sunlight from metal, a flashing strobe, bright flames, rising smoke, anything. Nothing. She was gone. Miami approach hit the alarm signals to the Coast Guard and other rescue forces. Choppers bolted from the ground and raced to the last known position of the National 727. Nothing. Then, precisely 10 minutes after the radar blip vanished from the set scopes in Miami approach, the blip reappeared before the astonished eyes of the people now crowded around that radar position. Reappearance was strange enough, but this was 10 minutes after the 727 had disappeared, and now it had reappeared in exactly the same position it held in flight when it vanished, both on radar and in flight. It may have moved slightly, but only enough to cause a 10-minute time slip. The 727 pilot continued talking with Miami Approach and then Miami Tower in an absolutely calm voice. Nothing unusual could be discerned from his tone or his words. The still astounded radar operator worked the 727 in closer and then handed off the airliner to the tower for final landing instructions. The 727 slid in, flaps extended and gear down, and made an absolutely normal landing. The airliner was directed to park in an area separate from the terminal gate. When it stopped and the doors opened, federal investigators and officials of National couldn't get into that jetliner fast enough. The crew regarded with some astonishment of their own this unexpected and unexplained flurry of activity and barrage of questions. Then they were told what had happened. You disappeared from the scope on your descent. For 10 minutes, there was no radar picture of you people. When you came back on the scope, your position was exactly where it had been. Not only that, but several airliners flew through the space you had occupied in those 10 minutes. What happened up there? The crew and the passengers who were questioned were in a different situation. Something incredible had happened to them, and they didn't know the first thing about it. Nothing happened, the captain insisted. Nothing out of the ordinary, that is. We were on approach, and we came in, and we got tower, and we landed. Period. No break in communications? None. Caden goes on to say that one of the flight crew checked his watch, compared it with everyone else's in the flight crew, and then checked it against all the other clocks throughout the aircraft. Every one of their own clocks told the same time, but they were all 10 minutes behind. The Bermuda Triangle was a classic book I read at the beginning of my quest, but it took me years to understand and explain what actually happened. Since this is a very technical discussion, I deliberately have not presented all the evidence for how Larson solved the mysteries of quantum mechanics and astrophysics. If you really want to roll up your sleeves and get the specifics, there is a tremendous amount of written material available to read, and it's all been posted for free online. My colleague, Dr. Bruce Perrette, who runs the RS Theory website, his associate, Dr. K. Nehru, and others in the International Society for Unified Science, are actively developing the model past the point Larson started with. Eric Julian independently rediscovered some of the same concepts, as well as others that are not in Larson's model, in The Science of Extraterrestrials, which is also very technical and has gained the appreciation of respected Russian scientists. Mass decreases as we reach the speed of light. Here's the burning question that immediately pops into my mind. If time-space really exists, then how do we get there? Once we have that answer, we may very well be able to dematerialize, teleport, and travel in time, which would certainly make for a very interesting and fun-filled golden age. The first big clue I found for how we could directly enter into time-space came from Dr. Vladimir Ginzburg. In his books and technical papers, Ginzburg reveals another mistake Einstein made in the theory of relativity. In my opinion, Einstein did a great job. We just need to fix up a few things. As you may already know, conventional relativity theory says nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. Einstein's equations suggested that as you approach the speed of light, you gain mass. You can never actually reach the speed of light because theoretically, at the speed of light, you are now as massive as the entire universe. Ginzburg, however, made a revolutionary discovery. You could turn that same relativity equation upside down. In the process, everything still works. You don't violate any laws of physics, but there is one major difference. As you approach the speed of light, you lose mass instead of gaining it. This means that once you reach light speed, you have no mass left, at least not in space-time. This simple change to one Einstein equation has absolutely stunning implications for human civilization. Here's how Ginzburg explains it on his website. You may not be prepared to abandon immediately the century-old relativistic equations, but once you are ready to do so, you will discover many amazing things. Only when a particle is at rest, it may be considered as pure matter. As soon as the particle begins to move, its gravitational mass and electrical charge will start to decrease. So a part of that matter will be converted into a field. When the particle velocity v becomes equal to the ultimate spiral field velocity c, the speed of light, its gravitational mass and electric charge become equal to zero. At this point, matter will be completely converted into a pure field. Now we're on to something. If we can push the whirling movement inside an atom past the speed of light, then we've just popped that atom over into time-space. It wasn't until very recently that I realized there was an even more important concept hiding behind this. The motion inside the atom is already going at the speed of light, or very close to it, so it doesn't take much to finish the job. Right then, years and years of weird little scientific facts I had been collecting in my mind all came together, and I had one of the finest eureka moments of my entire life. Just a little push. Physical matter is always right on the edge between these two realities. All we need to do is give it a little push to get it over the boundary and flip it into time-space. This is how our buckyballs were able to turn into a wave just by slamming against a wall. Protons, neutrons, electrons, and atoms in the quantum realm are flip-flopping all the time. You can't necessarily see the atoms disappear out of a solid object when they flip into waves. But once I realized this is what they were doing, it became clear that others had observed and measured it happening. For example, Dr. Nikolai Kozarev found that simply smashing an object against a hard surface would cause its weight to decrease. In one case, he smashed a ball bearing against a lead plate and weighed it before and after the collision. In another case, he dropped a piece of lead against a stone basement floor. Some of the atoms popped over into time-space just from being bumped, and the objects weighed less. Even better, these experiments showed that the weight defect does not disappear immediately after a collision, but decreases gradually, with relaxation times of about 15 to 20 minutes. That means that the missing weight slowly comes back as those atoms quiet back down. They don't immediately return to light or sublight speeds. There is a 15 to 20 minute delay involved. This again suggests we are dealing with a fluid-like flow between our two parallel realities of space-time and time-space. Smashing the objects with violence wasn't necessary either. In another experiment, Kozarev found that simply shaking a weight up and down 30 times by hand was enough to cause its weight to go down. The strangest part of all was that the weight did not all come back in a nice smooth curve. It came back in sudden little quantized jumps over time. Each time the weight suddenly changed, its newest increase in mass was proportional to the others. Each weight change was also proportional to the total amount of mass that disappeared in the first place. If this is confusing, the easiest way I can explain it is by using a hypothetical example. If you smash a weight and it loses 100 milligrams, let's say, it might initially gain back 10 milligrams. Then you wait, but nothing happens. Then, suddenly, it gets 10 milligrams heavier. Then nothing happens for a while. Then 10 more milligrams appear. This keeps on happening over the course of 15 to 20 minutes. According to Kozarev, we succeeded in obtaining 5-fold and even 10-fold effects. He also found out that this so-called effect quantization actually takes place in almost all the experiments. So again, we are looking at a basic property of physical matter. As the atoms pop back in from time-space, They don't do so in a nice, smooth, even fashion. It's as if there were layers within each atom. Each layer only pops in once it has slowed back down enough to cross over the light speed boundary. That means individual atoms could be both in and out of our reality at the same time, depending on which layer you're looking at. This will make much more sense once we discuss the layers of geometry you will find within each atom, but that comes later. So again, the basic idea is that by smashing, bumping, or even just shaking an object, some of its atoms pop over into time-space and its weight goes down. This also explains Dr. Bruce De Palma's mysterious spinning ball experiment. De Palma was working for Polaroid in photographic sciences and lectured part-time at MIT. One of his students wanted to see if there was a difference between the effect of gravity on a rotating object and a non-rotating object. De Palma designed an experiment to help find the answer. Two 1-inch wide ball bearings were given a precisely measured thrust that should normally cause them to rise and fall in exactly the same arc. The only difference between the two was that De Palma used a hand router to get one of them spinning at 18,000 revolutions per minute, or 300 revolutions per second, first. So this is obviously a very fast spin. He then launched them off in the dark and photographed the results with a 60-cycle strobe light. The results were explained on the official Bruce De Palma website. Repeating this numerous times and analyzing the parallel trajectories of the ball bearings as documented photographically, the rotating ball went to a higher point in its trajectory, fell faster, and hit the bottom of its trajectory before the non-rotating ball bearing. Since the spinning ball traveled higher, that obviously meant it had become lighter. And since it plunged faster than ordinary gravity should allow, that also suggested it was then moving slightly faster in time as well. De Palma didn't know exactly what was causing the ball to fly higher, but once I figured it out, many other pieces fit together. Nares saw the same thing when he slammed a buckyball against the wall, and Kozarev saw it by smashing ball bearings and vigorously shaking weights. Then, when we add in Ginzburg, we now have a theoretical framework. As soon as a particle begins to move, part of it will transform into pure field. De Palma found that you didn't even need to shoot the balls through the air. Simply dropping two ball bearings straight down from a height of only 6 feet repeatedly demonstrated a small but significant and clearly perceptible effect if one of them was rotating at a fast speed. De Palma got his results published in the British Scientific Research Association Journal in 1976. He also explained it to Dr. Edward Purcell, one of Harvard's top experimental physicists. Dr. Purcell definitely realized what the implications of this really were. According to De Palma, Purcell, after contemplating the experiment for several minutes, remarked, "This will change everything." In his 1977 paper on the spinning ball experiment, De Palma revealed he had the same basic idea as Kozarev. Time, as a manifestation of a much deeper and basic force, is what we have a concern for here. The point of connection I want to make is the inertia of objects relates to the time energy flowing through them. Sounds familiar? So far, all we've done is create a small effect that you need special laboratory equipment to even notice. That's not very exciting. How do we get the really good stuff to happen on a larger scale? In order to find the answer, we have to go back and take another look at gravity. Remember that in Larson's model, gravity is all there is. Atoms and molecules are nothing more than vortexes within an energy field we call gravity.